Unless otherwise indicated, Ratchet Book Club is intended for a mature audience. Viewer discretion is greatly advised. Welcome to Ratchet Book Club, where I read hood classics and good classics. No, fuck that. That's not good enough. God damn. Welcome back to the Ratchet Book Club, and that's me. Welcome back. Oh yeah. God damn, I hated that book. If y'all are reading these out of order, thanks. I do it all the time. I really listen to myself. I listen to myself out of order. I just finished listening to The Life and Death of Bobby Z while I was picking through reading this fucking book. That book was so fucking bad. And if y'all don't know what book I'm talking about, it can either be Horsin' or it could be raunchy. Depending on what order you're reading this in. It could be either or. But I'm a drop a little hint to you. I'm not telling. They were both pretty fucking horrible. One was worse than the other, though, by a fucking large margin. And we talk about it in the one that's worse than the other. That's a hint. So, yeah, after, goddamn, I did that after I did Fly Girl. I am just constipated with good books. Like, that was just the stoppage of good books while I read through those two pieces of shit. And so, I, being a sound mind and body, and knowing what the fuck I like, am I gonna read something the fuck I like? And I know you're gonna like what the fuck I like, because the shit that I like is B-A-N-A-N-A-S. Yeah, the shit that I like is bananas. The last time that I read you a book that I liked, it was fucking out of this world. And that was Sideways Stories from Wayside School, which was a really short book. This is going to be a while. Actually, I got three books back to back to back. I'm like the Chicago Bulls in this bitch. I got three books that I'm going to be reading to y'all. And then I might read something else. There's this book that I've had for a while that I need to get taken care of. But for right now, sheesh, let's go. Let's fucking go. Also, happy birthday to me. Ratchet Book Club, 3 years in. Man, for those of y'all who have been with me the whole fucking journey, I appreciate you so much. For those who haven't, you're welcome. You're welcome. I'm changing the game on these hoes. Step by step, day by day, changing the game on these hoes. That's what I do. Did y'all know I couldn't read? I'm not joking. Like, I can read to myself, but when I first started Ratchet Book Club, I had a real problem with reading out loud. I stuttered. I switch words. I see stuff that isn't there. I speed through stuff and mess up and flub and all that kind of shit. It was really bad when I first started. It's gotten a lot better. You're welcome. I've worked hard on this. Also, since it's my third, I'm going to say leave a review. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pod Chaser. You know, all of the pods. Check out Hindsight Movie Reviews. That's my other podcast. I do movie reviews. And you know it's fucking dope because you're listening to this. Check out the Return to Oswald Podcast Network. That's me too. I discuss TV shows. Right now we're doing Breaking Bad. But start at Oz. That shit was fantastic. The show's not. But the recaps that me, Scar, and Brandon do are fan fucking. I'm so happy about this shit. So happy. So you know my nigga Dean Koontz, right? You know my nigga Dean. My nigga Dean is the one who wrote From the Corner of His Eye, which is a fucking masterpiece. And read that and it made me feel great. And there's more Dean Koontz books that make me feel great. And so after going through a pile of shit, I want to feel great. I'm like fucking Halle Berry in Monster Ball. Make me feel good. I've never seen that fucking movie. Never. But I got YouTube. So I know what she says. And I know when. I've also never seen Swordfish, but I know her for the very same reason. YouTube. Yeah. YouTube was created because the originator of YouTube was mad that he couldn't find Nipplegate. He couldn't look it up anywhere. He couldn't find it anywhere. So he made a video repository and that begat YouTube. Crazy, right? Doesn't seem like that long ago that Justin Timberlake was fucking over Janet Jackson's whole ass career by ripping her shirt off. And then being like, hey, dude. But yeah, man, this book right here is so fucking good. I just want to lavish in it. Like duck confit. Duck confit is made by cooking duck in its own fat. It takes a while, but the flavors are fucking resplendent. This is confit. I want y'all to sit in this for a second and just love it. And then the next book after that. And then the next book after that. God, it feels so good to be back. With no further ado, I present to you and your whole crew who knows how to make it do what it do. Whoop! Life Expectancy by Dean Koontz. But he that dares not grasp the thorn should never crave the rose. Anne Bronte, The Narrow Way. Here's a sigh to those who love me, and a smile to those who hate. And whatever sky's above me, here's a heart for every fate. Lord Byron to Thomas More. Don't worry, it ain't gonna be one of them type of books. I know if you have Anne Bronte and Lord Byron back to back on quotes, you're like, man, this shit's about to be some old ass, historical ass, boring ass shit. Do I look like the type of nigga who will read that shit to you? I mean, on purpose, like on accident. Yeah, I would. I'd be like, this shit is horrible and keep going. But on purpose? No. Nah, I'm not that type of nigga. Part one. Welcome to the world, Jimmy Tok. Chapter one. On the night that I was born, my paternal grandfather, Joseph Tok, made 10 predictions that shaped my life. Then he died in the very minute that my mother gave birth to me. Joseph had never previously engaged in fortune telling. He was a pastry chef. He made eclairs and lemon tarts, not predictions. Some lives conducted with grace are beautiful arcs bridging this world to eternity. I am 30 years old and can't for certain see the course of my life, but rather than a graceful arc, my passage seems to be a herky-jerky line from one crisis to another. I am a lummox. By which I do not mean stupid, only that I'm biggish for my size and not always aware of where my feet are going. This truth is not offered in a spirit of self-deprecation or even humility. Apparently, being a lummox is part of my charm, an almost winsome trait, as you'll see. No doubt, I have now raised in your mind the question of what I intend to imply by biggish for my size. Autobiography has proven to be a trickier task than I first imagined. I'm not as tall as people seem to think I am. In fact, not tall at all by the standards of professional or even of high school basketball. I'm neither plump nor as buff as an iron-pumping fitness fanatic. At most, I'm somewhat husky. Yet men taller and heavier than me often call me Big Guy. My nickname in school was Moose. From childhood, I've heard people joke about how astronomical our grocery bills must be. The disconnect between my true size and many people's perception of my dimensions has always mystified me. Check this out, y'all. This is me. There's a million nicknames that I have for my wife. I have a million of them. Y'all don't know the half. Y'all just probably know her as my beloved wife, Nisha. And she is. I'm literally looking off into the stars that aren't even here thinking about her. But there's a million things that I call her. And they all drip of love. My wife, this is him, this isn't me. My wife, who is the linchpin of my life, claims that I have a presence much bigger than my physique. She says that people measure me by the impression I make on them. I find this notion ludicrous. It's bullshit born of love. If sometimes I make an outsized impression on people, it's as likely as not because I fell on them or stepped on their feet. In Arizona, there's a place where a drop ball appears to roll uphill in defiance of gravity. In truth, this effect is a trick of perspective in which elements of an unusual landscape conspire to deceive the eye. I suspect that I am a similar freak of nature. Perhaps light reflects oddly from me or bends around me in a singular fashion, so I appear to be more of a Hulk than I am. On the night I was born in Snow County Hospital in the community of Snow Village, Colorado, my grandfather told a nurse that I would be 20 inches long and weigh 8 pounds, 10 ounces. The nurse was startled by this prediction, not because 8 pounds, 10 is a huge newborn, many are larger, and not because my grandfather was a pastry chef who suddenly began acting as though he were a crystal ball gazer. 4 days previously, he had suffered a massive stroke that left him paralyzed on his right side and unable to speak. Yet from his bed in the intensive care unit, he began making prognostications in a clear voice, without slur or hesitation. He also told her that I'll be born at 10:46 p.m. and that I will suffer from syndactyly. That is a word difficult to pronounce before a stroke, let alone after one. Syndactyly, as the observing nurse explained to my father, is a congenital defect in which two or more fingers or toes are joined. In serious cases, the bones of adjacent digits are fused to such an extent that two fingers share a single nail. Multiple surgeries are required to correct such a condition and to ensure that the afflicted child will grow into an adult capable of giving the FU finger to anyone who sufficiently annoys him. In my case, the trouble was toes. Two were fused on the left foot, three on the right. My mother, Madeline, who my father affectionately calls Maddie, or sometimes the Mad One, insists that they consider foregoing the surgery and instead christening me Flipper. Flipper was the name of a dolphin that once starred in a hit TV show, not surprisingly titled Flipper, in the late 60s. My mother describes the program as delightfully, wonderfully, hilariously stupid. It went off the air a few years before I was born. Flipper, a male, was played by a trained dolphin named Susie. This was most likely the first instance of transvestism on television. Actually, that's not the right word, because transvestism is a male dressing as a female for sexual gratification. Besides, Susie, alias Flipper, didn't wear clothes. I don't think it's for sexual gratification, though. I don't think that's how it works. I think it's just because they feel comfortable within it, which is not sexual gratification at all. That's just comfort. I don't know. I know, though. I'm fucking right. So it was a program in which the female star always appeared nude and was sufficiently butch to pass for a male. Just 2 nights ago at dinner, over one of my mother's infamous cheese and broccoli pies, she asked rhetorically if it was any wonder that such a dire collapse in broadcast standards, begun with Flipper, should lead to a boring freak show shocked at his contemporary television. Playing her game, my father said, it actually began with Lassie. In every show, she was nude too. Lassie was always played by male dogs, my mother replied. There you go, Dad said, his point made. I escaped being named Flipper when successful surgeries returned my toes to normal condition. In my case, the fusion involved only skin, not bones. The separation was a relatively simple procedure. Nevertheless, on that uncommonly stormy night, my grandfather's prediction of syndactyly proved true. If I had been born on a night of unremarkable weather, family legend would have transformed it into an eerie calm, every leaf motionless in breathless air, night birds silent with expectation. The Tock family has a proud history of self-dramatization. Even allowing for exaggeration, the storm must have been violent enough to shake the Colorado mountains to their rocky foundations. The heavens cracked and flashed as the celestial armies were at war. Still in the womb, I remained unaware of all the thunderclaps, and once born, I was probably distracted by my strange feet. This was August 9th, 1974, the day Richard Nixon resigned as President of the United States. Nixon's fall has no more to do with me than the fact that John Denver's Annie song was the number one record in the country at the time. I mention it only to provide historical perspective. Nixon or no Nixon, what I find most important about August 9, 1974 is my birth and my grandfather's predictions. My sense of perspective has an egocentric taint. Perhaps more clearly than if I had been there, because of vivid pictures painted by numerous family stories of that night, I could see my father, Rudy Tock, walking back and forth from one end of County Hospital to the other, between the maternity ward and the ICU, between joy at the prospect of his son's pending arrival and grief over his beloved father's quickening slide into death. With blue vinyl tile floor, pale green wainscoting, pink walls, a yellow ceiling, and orange and white stork pattern drapes, the expectant father's lounge churned with the negative energy of color overload. It would have served well as the nervous-making set for a nightmare about a children's show host who led a secret life as an axe murderer. The chain-smoking clown didn't improve the ambiance. Rudy stood birth watch with only one other man. Not a local, but a performer with the circus that was playing a one-week engagement in a meadow at the Holloway Farm. He called himself Bezo. Curiously, this proved not to be his clown name, but one that he was born with. Conrad Bezo. Some say there's no such thing as destiny, that what happens just happens, without purpose or meaning. Conrad's surname would argue otherwise. Bezo was married to Natalie, a trapeze artist and a member of a renowned aerialist family that qualified as circus royalty. Neither of Natalie's parents, none of her brothers or sisters, and none of her high-flying cousins had accompanied Bezo to the hospital. This was a performance night, and as always, the show must go on. Evidently, the aerialists kept their distance also because they had not approved of one of their kind taking a clown for a husband. Every subculture and ethnicity has its objects of bigotry. As Bezo waited nervously for his wife to deliver, he muttered unkind judgments of his in-laws. Self-satisfied, he called them, and devious. The clown's perpetual glower, rough voice, and bitterness made Rudy uncomfortable. Angry words plumed from an exhalation of sour smoke, duplicitous and scheming, and, poetically for a clown, blithe spirits of the air, but treacherous when the ground is under them. Bezo wasn't in full costume. Furthermore, his stage clothes were in the Emmett Kelly sad face tradition, rather than the bright polka dot plumage of the average Ringling Brothers clown. He cut a strange figure nonetheless. A bright plaid patch blazed across the seat of his baggy brown suit. The sleeves of his jacket were comically short. In one lapel bloomed a fake flower, the diameter of a bread plate. Before racing to the hospital with his wife, he had traded clown shoes for sneakers and had taken off his big, round, red rubber nose. White grease paint still encircled his eyes, however, and his cheeks remained heavily rouged, and he wore a rumpled pork pie hat. Be those bloodshot eyes shun as scarlet as his painted cheeks, perhaps because of the acrid smoke wreathing his head. Although Rudy suspected the strong drink might be involved as well. In those days, smoking was permitted everywhere, even in many hospital waiting rooms. Expectant fathers traditionally gave out cigars by way of celebration. When not at his dying father's bedside, poor Rudy should have been able to take refuge in that lounge. His grief should have been mitigated by the joy of his pending parenthood. Instead, both Maddie and Natalie were long in labor. Each time that Rudy returned from the ICU, waiting for him was a glowering, muttering, bloody-eyed clown, burning through pack after pack of unfiltered Lucky Strikes. As drum rolls of thunder shook the heavens, as reflections of lightning shuddered through the windows, Bezo made a stage of the maternity ward lounge, restlessly circling the blue vinyl floor. From pink wall to pink wall, he smoked and fumed. "Do you believe the snakes can fly, Rudy Tock? Of course you don't, but snakes can fly. I've seen them high above the center ring. They're well paid and applauded. These cobras, these diamondbacks, these copperheads, these hateful vipers." Poor Rudy responded to this vituperant rant with murmured consolation, clucks of the tongue, and sympathetic nods. He didn't want to encourage Bezo, but he sensed that a failure to commiserate would make him a target for the clown's anger. Pausing at a storm-washed window, his painted face further patinated by the lightning-cast patterns of the streaming raindrops on the glass, Bezo said, "Which are you having, Rudy Tock? A son or daughter?" Bezo consistently addressed Rudy by his first and last names, as if the two were one, Rudy Tock. "They have a new ultrasound scanner here," Rudy replied, "so they can tell us whether it's a boy or a girl. But we don't wanna know. If it's got a dick, keep it on the low." "We don't wanna know. We just care that the baby's healthy. And it is." Bezo's posture straightened, and he raised his head, thrusting his face towards the window as if to bask in the pulsing stormlight. "I don't need ultrasound to tell me what I know. Natalie has given me a son. Now the Bezo name won't die when I do. I'll call him Punchinello, after one of the first and greatest of clowns." Punchinello Bezo, Rudy thought. Oh, the poor child. "He will be the greatest of our kind, the very greatest," said Bezo. "The ultimate jester, harlequin, jack pudding. He'll be acclaimed from coast to coast, on every continent." Although Rudy had just returned to the maternity ward from the ICU, he felt imprisoned by this clown, whose dark energy seemed to swell each time the storm flashed in his feverish eyes. "He will not be merely acclaimed, but immortal." Rudy was hungry for news of Maddie's condition and the progress of her labor. In those days, fathers were seldom admitted to delivery rooms to witness the birth of their children. "He will be the circus star of his time, Rudy Tock. And everyone who sees him perform will know Conrad Bezo is his father. Patriarch of clowns." The ward nurses who should have regularly visited the lounge to speak with the waiting husbands were making themselves less visible than usual. No doubt, they were uncomfortable in the presence of this angry bozo. "On my father's grave, I swear my Punchinello will never be an aerialist," Bezo declared. The blast of thunder punctuating his vow was the first of two, so powerful that the window panes vibrated like drum heads, and the lights, almost extinguished, throbbed dimly. "What do acrobatics have to do with the truth of the human condition?" Bezo demanded. "Nothing," Rudy said at once, for he was not an aggressive man. Indeed, he was gentle and humble, not yet a pastry chef like his father, merely a baker who, on the verge of fatherhood, wished to avoid being severely beaten by a large clown.
"Comedy and tragedy, the very tools of the clown's art, that is the essence of life," Bezo declared.
Comedy, tragedy, and the need for good bread, Rudy said, making a little joke, including his own trade and the essence of life professions. This small frivolity earned him a fierce glare, a look that seemed capable of not merely of stopping clocks, but freezing time. Comedy, tragedy, and the need for good bread, Bezo repeated, perhaps expecting Dad to admit his quip had been inane. Hey, Dad said, that sounds just like me. For the clown had spoken in a voice that might have passed for my father's. Hey, that sounds just like me, Bezo mocked in Dad's voice. Then he continued his own rough growl.
I told you I'm talented, Rudy Tok, in more ways than you can imagine.
Rudy thought he could feel his chilled heart beating slower, winding down under the influence of that wintry gaze.
My boy will never be an aerialist. The hateful snakes will hiss. Oh, how they'll hiss and thrash. But Punchinello will never be an aerialist.
Another tsunami of thunder broke against the walls of the hospital. And again, the lights were more than half drowned. In that gloom, Rudy swore that the tip of Bezo's cigarette in his right hand glowed brighter, brighter. Although he held it at his side, as if some phantom presence were drawing on it with eager lips. Rudy thought, but could not swear, that Bezo's eyes briefly glowed as bright and as red as the cigarette. This could not have been an inner light, of course, but a reflection of something. When the echoes of the thunder rolled away, the brownout passed. As the lights rose, so did Rudy rise from his chair. He had only recently returned there, and although he had received no news about his wife, he was ready to flee back to the grim scene in the intensive care unit rather than experience a third doomsday pill and another dimming of lights in the company of Conrad Bezo. When he arrived at the ICU and found two nurses at his father's bedside, Rudy feared the worst. He knew that Joseph was dying, yet his throat tightened and tears welled when he thought the end loomed. To his surprise, he discovered Joseph half sitting up in bed, hands clutching the side rails, excitedly repeating the predictions that he had already made to one of the nurses. 20 inches, 8 pounds, 10 ounces, 10:46 tonight, syndactyl. When he saw his son, Joseph pulled himself all the way into a sitting position, and one of the nurses raised the upper half of the bed to support him better. He had not only regained his speech, but also appeared to have overcome the partial paralysis that had followed his stroke. When he seized Rudy's right hand, his grip proved firm, even painful. Astonished by this development, Rudy at first assumed that his father had experienced a miraculous recovery. Then, however, he recognized the desperation of a dying man with an important message to impart. Joseph's face was drawn, seemed almost shrunken, as if death, in a sneak thief mood, had begun days ago to steal the substance of him, ounce by ounce. By contrast, his eyes appeared to be enormous. Fear sharpened his gaze when his eyes fixed on his son.
5 days, said Joseph, his hoarse voice raw with suffering, parched because he had been taking fluids only intravenously. 5 terrible days.
Easy, Dad. Don't excite yourself, Rudy cautioned. But he saw that on the cardiac monitor, the illuminated graph of his father's heart activity revealed a fast yet regular pattern. One of the nurses left to summon a doctor. The other stepped back from the bed, waiting to assist if the patient experienced a seizure. First, licking his cracked lips to wet the way for his whisper, he made his 5th prediction.
James. His name will be James, but no one will call him James. Or Jim. Everyone will call him Jimmy.
This startled Rudy. He and Maddie had chosen James if the baby was a boy, Jennifer if it was a girl, but they had not discussed their choices with anyone. Joseph couldn't have known. Yet, he knew. With increasing urgency, Joseph declared,
5 days. You've got to warn him. 5 terrible days.
Easy, Dad, Rudy repeated. You'll be okay. His father, as pale as the cut face of a loaf of bread, grew paler, whiter than flour in a measuring cup.
Not okay. I'm dying.
You aren't dying. Look at you. You're speaking. There's no paralysis. You're
dying,
Joseph insisted, his rough voice rising in volume. His pulse throbbed at his temples, and on the monitor, it grew more rapid as he strained to break through his son's reassurances and to seize his attention.
5 dates. Write them down. Write them now. Now!
Confused, afraid that Joseph's adamancy might trigger another stroke, Rudy mollified his father. He borrowed a pen from the nurse. She didn't have any paper, and she wouldn't let him use the patient's chart that hung on the foot of the bed. From his wallet, Rudy withdrew the first thing he found that offered a clean writing surface. A free pass to the very circus in which Bezo performed. Rudy had received the pass a week ago from Huey Foster, a Snow Village police officer. They had been friends since childhood. Huey, like Rudy, had wanted to be a pastry chef, but he didn't have the talent for a career in baking. His muffins broke teeth. His lemon tarts offended the tongue. When, by virtue of his law enforcement job, Huey received freebies, passes to the circus, booklets of tickets for carnival rides at the county fair, sample boxes of bullets from various ammo manufacturers, he shared them with Rudy. In return, Rudy gave Huey cookies that didn't sour the appetite, cakes that didn't displease the nose, pies and strudels that didn't induce regurgitation. Red and black lettering, illustrated with elephants and lions, crowded the face of the circus pass. The reverse was blank. Unfolded, it measured 3 by 5 inches, the size of an index card. As hard rain beat on the nearby window, drumming up sound like many running feet, Joseph clutched again at the railing, anchoring himself as if he feared that he might float up and away.
1994,
September 15th,
a Thursday, write it down.
Standing beside the bed, Rudy took dictation using the precise printing with which he composed recipe cards. September 15th, 1994, Thursday. Eyes wide and wild like those of a rabbit in the thrall of a stalking coyote, Joseph stared toward the point high on the wall opposite his bed. He seemed to see more than the wall, something beyond it, perhaps the future.
Warn him, the dying man said. For God's sake, warn him.
Bewildered, Rudy said, warn who?
Jimmy, your son, Jimmy, my grandson.
He's not born yet.
Almost 2 minutes. Warn him.
1998, January 19th, a Monday. It was, too, because my birthday was on a Sunday. And I had the club going up on a Tuesday because I take the whole week off for work. From work on my birthday. My birthday's a holiday. If you have the opportunity to do it, I recommend you do it too. Like, take the whole week off, but don't go anywhere. Just stay home. It's really fetch. It's the best. Like, honestly, I'm not saying I hate my job or anything like that, but I've done it every single year since the age of 18. I haven't done anything that had to do with work. It also helps that my birthday is right around Martin Luther King Day, so that Monday, I usually get off anyway, but still. Transfixed by the ghastly expression on his father's face, Rudy stood with a pen poised over paper.
Write it down!
Joseph roared, his mouth contorted so severely in the shout that his dry and peeling lower lip split. A crimson thread slowly unraveled down his chin.
1998, Rudy muttered as he wrote. January 19th,
Joseph repeated in a croak, his parched throat having been racked by the shout.
A Monday. Terrible day.
Why?
Terrible, terrible.
Why will it be terrible? Rudy persisted. 2002, December 23rd, another Monday. Jotting down his third date, Rudy said, Dad, this is weird. I don't understand. Joseph held tight to both steel bed rails. Suddenly, he shook them violently, with such uncanny strength that the railing seemed to be coming apart at their joints, raising a clatter that would have been loud in an ordinary hospital room, but that was explosive in the usually hushed intensive care unit. At first, the observing nurse rushed forward, perhaps intending to calm the patient, but the electrifying combination of fury and terror that wrenched his pallid face caused her to hesitate. When waves of thunder broke against the hospital hard enough to shake dust off the acoustic ceiling tiles, the nurse retreated, almost as though she thought Joseph himself had summoned that detonation. "Write it down!" he demanded. I wrote, Rudy assured him. December 23rd, 2002, another Monday. 2003, Joseph said urgently. The 26th of November, a Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving. After recording this fourth day on the back of the circus pass, just as his father stopped shaking the bed rails, Rudy looked up and saw a fresh emotion in Joseph's face, in his eyes. The fury was gone. And the terror. As tears welled, Joseph said, "Poor Jimmy. Poor Rudy. Dad? Poor Rudy. Poor Jimmy. Where's Rudy?" "I'm Rudy, Dad. I'm right here." Joseph blinked, and flicked away the tears as yet another emotion gripped him. This one not easy to define. Some would have called it astonishment. Others would have said it was a wonder of the pure variety that a baby might express at the first sight of any bright marvel or at a black person. I just want to say this real quick for white people to not scare you when you see me. I will scare you when I see you, but that's on you. You need to work on that personally. It's not a me thing. That's you. That's a you thing. You ought to be fucking ashamed of yourself. Donate to the show. But I fucking treasure being the first black person that a white baby or an Asian baby or a Mexican baby or any baby other than black sees. And the reason why is because they are so used to seeing this one color, this one race, because their parents usually don't take them outside much that first month, you know, whatever, that when they take them to the grocery store and they see you, oh my God, it is so fucking adorably just bewildering to that baby. They just look at you like, "How you do that? How you do that there? With the brown skin and the curly hair, say." And you just like, "Hi, baby." And then the parents are like, oh, you're not trying to kidnap my baby or eat its soul. You're not like what my grandparents said you were. And that's the whole thing. Also, parents, if you're hearing this and you have a baby and the baby is like a baby, like maybe even 3 months or up. When they start laughing, record their laugh. Record their laugh, always. Every time you hear them with a new laugh, record it the next time they do it, because their laugh constantly changes. And you're going to want the laugh that they had when they were like one, when they're nine. You're going to want to hear it again. So record them and upload them to the cloud, and that way you got them. You're welcome. Send me a donation for that, too. That shit's dope. After a moment, Rudy recognized it as a state more profound than wonder. This was awe, the complete yielding of the mind to something grand and formidable. His father's eyes shone with amazement. Across his face, expressions of delight and apprehension contested with one another. Joseph's increasingly raspy voice fell to a whisper.
2005.
His gaze remained fixed on another reality that apparently he found more convincing than he did this world in which he had lived for 57 years. Hand trembling now, but still printing legibly, Rudy recorded this fifth date and waited. "Ah," said Joseph, as if a startling secret had been revealed. "Dad?
Not this.
Not this," Joseph lamented. "Dad, what's wrong?" As curiosity outweighed her anxiety, the rattled nurse ventured closer to the bed. A doctor entered the cubicle. "What's going on here?" Joseph said,
Don't trust the clown.
The physician looked mildly offended, assuming that the patient had just questioned his medical credentials. Leaning over the bed, trying to redirect his father's attention from his otherworldly vision, Rudy said, "Dad, how do you know about the clown?"
"The 16th of April," said Joseph.
"How do you know about the clown? Write it down!" Joseph thundered, even as the heavens crashed against the earth once more. As the doctor went around to the other side of the bed, Rudy added April 16th after 2005 to the fifth line on the back of the circus pass. He also printed Saturday when his father spoke it. The doctor put a hand under Joseph's chin and turned his head to have a better look into his eyes.
"He isn't who you think he is," said Joseph, not to the doctor, but to his son.
"Who isn't?" Rudy asked.
"He isn't."
"Who's he?"
"Now, Joseph," the physician chided, "you know me very well. I'm Dr. Pickett."
"Oh, the tragedy," Joseph said, voice ripe with pity, as if he were not a pastry chef, but a thespian upon the Shakespearean stage.
"What tragedy?" Rudy worried.
Producing an ophthalmoscope from the pocket of his white smock, Dr. Pickett disagreed.
"No tragedy here. What I see is a remarkable recovery."
Breaking loose of the physician's chin grip, increasingly agitated, Joseph said,
"Kidneys!"
Bewildered, Rudy said, "Kidneys?
Why should kidneys be so damn important?" Joseph demanded.
"It's absurd! It's all absurd!" Rudy felt his heart sink at this, for it seemed that his dad's brief clarity of mind had begun to give way to babble. Asserting control of his patient again by once more gripping his chin, Dr. Pickett switched on the ophthalmoscope and directed the light in Joseph's right eye. As though that narrow beam were a piercing needle and his life were a balloon, Joseph talked out an explosive breath and slumped back upon his pillow. Dead. With all of the techniques and instruments available to a well-equipped hospital, attempts at resuscitation were made, but to no avail. Joseph had moved on and wasn't coming back. And I, James Henry Tock, arrived. The time on my grandfather's death certificate matches that on my birth certificate, 10:46 p.m. Bereaved, Rudy understandably lingered at Joseph's bedside. He had not forgotten his wife, but grief immobilized him. 5 minutes later, he received word from a nurse that Maddie had experienced a crisis in her labor and that he must go at once to her side. Alarmed by the prospect of losing his father and his wife in the same hour, Dad fled the intensive care unit. As he tells it, the halls of our modest county hospital had become a white labyrinth, and at least twice he made wrong turns. Too impatient to wait for the elevator, he raced down the stairs from the third floor to the ground level before realizing he had passed the second floor, on which the maternity ward was located. Dad arrived in the expectant father's waiting lounge to a crack of a pistol as Conrad Bezo shot his wife's doctor. For an instant, Dad thought Bezo would use a clown gun, some trick firearm that squirted red ink. The doctor dropped to the floor, however. Not with comic flair, but with hideous finality. And the smell of blood plumed thick. Too real. Bezo turned to Dad and raised a pistol. In spite of the rumpled pork pie hat and the short sleeve coat and the bright patch on the seat of his pants, in spite of the white grease paint in the rouged cheeks, nothing about Conrad Bezo was clownish at that moment. His eyes were those of a jungle cat, and it was easy to imagine that the teeth bared in his snarl were tiger fangs. He loomed, the embodiment of murderous dementia, demonic. Dad thought that he too would have been shot. But Bezo said,
"Stay out of my way, Rudy Tock. I have no quarrel with you. You are not an aerialist."
Bezo shouldered through the door between the lounge and the maternity ward, slammed it shut behind him. Dad knelt beside the doctor and discovered that a breath of life remained in him. The wounded man tried to speak. Couldn't. Blood had pooled in his throat and he gagged. Gently elevating the physician's head, shoving old magazines under it to brace the man at an angle that allowed him to breathe, Dad shouted for help as the swelling storm rocked the night with doomsday peals of thunder. Dr. Ferris McDonald had been Maddie's physician. He had also been called upon to treat Natalie Beza when, unexpectedly, she had been brought to the hospital in labor. Mortally wounded, he seemed more bewildered than frightened. Able to clear his throat and breathe now, he told my father, "She died during delivery, but it wasn't my fault." For a terrifying moment, my dad thought Maddie had died. Dr. McDonald realized this, for his last words were,
"Not Maddie, the clown's wife. Maddie is alive. I'm so sorry, Rudy."
Ferris McDonald died with my father's hand upon his heart. As the thunder rolled toward the far horizon, Dad heard another gunshot from beyond the door through which Conrad Beazle had vanished. Maddie lay somewhere behind that door, a woman left helpless by a difficult labor. I was back there too, an infant who was not yet enough flummoxed to defend himself. My father, then a baker, had never been a man of action, nor did he become one when, a few years later, he graduated to the status of pastry chef. He is of average height and weight, not physically weak, but not born for the boxing ring either. He had to that point led a charmed life, without serious want, without any strife. Nevertheless, fear for his wife and child cast him into a strange, cold panic, marked more by calculation than by hysteria. Without a weapon or a plan, but suddenly with the heart of a lion, he opened that door and he went after Beza. Although his imagination spun 1,000 bloody scenarios in mere seconds, he said he did not anticipate what was about to happen. And of course, he could not foresee how the events of that night would reverberate through the next 30 years with such terrible and astonishing consequences in his life and mine. So much better. It's like eating liver and then getting to eat something good. Like, fuck liver, too. But golly, I love this book. And y'all are going to love it, too. I guarantee. ratchetandratchet@gmail.com. Ratchet Book Club on Twitter. Ratchet Book Club on Facebook. Tell your friends about the show. Like, seriously, they need to listen to the good shit, too. Tell your family. Don't tell your enemies. I don't talk to my enemies. I don't expect you to. Yeah. You could leave a review for the show on Spotify. Takes like 13 seconds. You can also leave a review on Podchaser. Copy and paste that into the Good Pods app. And then copy and paste that into the Apple Podcast app. You could donate to the show at patreon.com/singlesimulcast. Or on buymeacoffee.com/sscast. Or on the Good Pods app, you can leave a tip in the tip jar. Thank y'all so much for listening. I greatly appreciate it. Y'all be good. I'm gonna holler at you later. Peace. Intro and outro to Ratchet Book Club is by That Kid Garan, and it's called Goodbyes. You can email him at tkgbeats94@gmail.com for more information on how to lease this beat.
This is Single Simulcast.